And this guy taps me on the shoulder. And he goes, hey, I was talking to her. And I go, oh, well, she wants to talk to me, not to you, so go away. And I turn back around, and he taps me on the shoulder again. And he said, I was talking to her. And I looked at him and said, as I'm thinking, this is my opportunity,
this
right?
This is like, the fight.
This
yeah.
is my fight. This yep. is fantastic. And it's going to happen next to a woman, right? This could work out.
Exactly.
So I turn around, I'm looking at him and said, buddy, if you want to go outside, I mean, we can. But I will let you know, I killed better men than you last week. And if we go outside, I'm going to break your neck and leave your dead body in the street. And I'm going to come back in here and finish my beer like it never happened. I said, or I'll buy you a beer, but you got to choose right now. And he goes, I'll have a Bud Light. So I turned to Erica, the bartender, and I'm like, hey, put a Bud Light on his tab for me. And
on his tab.
So, you know, put it on my tab. So she hands me a Bud Light. I hand it to this dude, and he goes away. I don't know who he is. I don't see him again. I don't know him.
Today on Two Dudes, One God Pod, we have Jared Stevens. I've got a history with Jared, which is really cool. It's cool to come to church one day and just see him here. But I think we're in for a treat. Pat and I have gotten to know Jared a little bit, and he's got some pretty awesome stories. In fact, he was telling me some like the story about how he met his wife, and I was like, dude, you got to come on the podcast and tell that.
Yeah.
And I think he said something like he would have to redact a lot of facts.
We have a redactor.
I appreciate it.
So, you know, I don't want to because it's lit. It's like you can't deny that God was involved in that whole deal. You know, like you probably could have gone to jail like three steps in that whole process.
Oh, yeah. There's
no, okay, I do not know this story at all. So this is going to be pretty hot and fresh right now.
It was an interesting night.
Yeah. Well, you know, I've gotten to know you over the past several, I guess, a year.
Couple, yeah.
What was it? You went through spring freedom weekend,
fall of 23.
Yeah. We're in spring 20. Okay, so like 18 months.
Yeah.
And you and I, we had a pretty big breakthrough,
both of us,
at freedom weekend, and you know that moment is always solidified in our friendship, and it's something that really brought us together. But you know, as you get to know people and you know people about their current situation, and you know, you've obviously spoken life into me a lot. You've been someone to encourage me, who sees me for me. And that's really difficult for me to find in people. So I definitely appreciate your friendship. But I don't know a lot about like how you grew up, like, you know, what was that like for Jared Stevens? Like, where are you from? When did God kind of start showing up in your life?
Well, I grew up in Duncanville, Texas, actually.
Okay.
My parents divorced when I was really young, about 6 years old, and bounced around quite a bit. I grew up in church. I went as a child, and we did all the Sunday stuff and Wednesday night stuff, but there was no real connection there for me.
Yeah.
Did they play paintball?
No.
Did they ride go-karts?
We did nothing.
Did they cut hair?
No, it was a very, very conservative church. And one
women wore skirts connected. And dresses.
Yeah, and you wore
to the
no pants.
No pants, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, that was refreshing. Yeah.
You know, they don't have any musical instruments. They don't have a choir.
Oh, wow. They are grassroots then.
Very, very old school. Okay. And you know, it wasn't a bad experience, but there wasn't a connection there. Mm. When my parents divorced, my mother was essentially thrown out of the church.
Wow, excommunicated.
They told her not to come back.
Yeah. Unclean.
So,
was it her fault?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's always both fault on that side, right? Mm. But she's the one that wanted the divorce and pushed that through. While that was difficult probably as a child, ultimately it worked out really well for both of my parents.
Yeah.
They're both happy, they've both remarried, and have been married more than 30 years both. So.
Well, that's interesting. I've given a lot of counsel to people because I've been divorced, and so people know you've been divorced, like all of a sudden they're like, man, things aren't good.
Me too.
And I've told a bunch of people, hey man, what are you doing? Oh, we're just going to try to stay married for the kids. I'm like, well, that's not the reason for marriage.
Yeah.
You know? And my personal take is I've watched a lot of kids get dragged through the mud, screaming, angry, violent household. Mm-hmm. And it's like, if both parents can't get on the same page and come to God and go, hey, whatever it takes, we're going to make this work for the marriage, for us, for, because that's what God wants. Yeah. Or we've prayed about this and God wants us to stay, you know, then I've seen a lot of kids. Absolutely. You know, and I'm like, hey, like divorce is terrible, but if you had cancer in your bone and your arm, it would suck to cut your arm off, but it'd be better to not have an arm than it would be to have cancer and die.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Know? And so I think divorce can be that. Sometimes it is an amputation, and for me, in my marriage, it was a spiritual amputation. It was, which took years to unwind, and you know, it sent me on a real journey. But like, so in your story, what you're saying is like your parents got divorced and like initially it was pretty tough. Yeah. But like in hindsight, you look back and you're like, my parents were happy and they found the right people to be with.
Without a doubt. It worked out real well for both of them. They've both been married, like I said, for over 30 years to their second marriage. And I had four parents and they were involved in my life. I lived between the two of them back and forth.
Like 50-50, like 1 week on?
No, just like me being an asshole and moving from one to the other. I probably moved 13 or 14 times before I moved out on my own. I moved out at 17 because of a girl. Because I was stupid.
You know, Steck has a saying about that.
and still am stupid sometimes. So, but it gave me a really interesting perspective in life. So I grew up with a family of six on my dad's side because the woman he married, my stepmother, had two sons of her own. And so there were three boys and a daughter in that household for a while, and not a whole lot of money. So we grew up in a less than ideal neighborhood in a, you know, rental house, and I think we were the only white family on the street, and there was some difficulties growing up there. You know, there's a lot of fights when I was a kid. And they had a drastically different lifestyle. They had been much more successful in their careers. And that showed me two different areas of life and kind of guiding that principle on where I wanted to end up. At 17, I moved out of the house, spent my senior year working three jobs and trying to get out of high school. I was a horrible student. And 5 days after I graduated high school, I went into the Marine Corps. So,
what did you do in the Marine Corps?
What year was that?
1995.
So fools give it to me.
That's it.
So. I was four.
Yeah. At least you were alive. I appreciate that.
I think I was 10.
You were fighting for my freedom.
So, and you have to understand that it was a different world back then. This was pre 9/11.
Yeah.
So, for the first 4 years that I was in the Marine Corps, they paid me to travel around the world and be a grown boy.
Yeah.
You know, I went to different countries and partied and had a good time and got out of the Marine Corps in 1999.
But you were there under training.
Yeah, something like that. Right. By the way, if you ever get a chance to go to Korea, highly recommend it. Great, great country. I got out of the Marine Corps in 1999 after 4 years of just playing and spending the taxpayers' money. Mm-hmm. And moved to Austin, Texas. Met my first wife there. Mm-hmm. And did, you know, the 3 years inactive reserve that they require of you. And when 9/11 happened, they needed people back in, and I signed back up. Definitely a drastic difference between the two enlistments that I had.
Definitely peacetime to wartime.
Yeah. So I got married right before. So 9/11 happened. I'd been dating this woman for a couple of years on and off. We had really nothing in common. It was not a good relationship. It had never been a good relationship.
It was just fun.
Lots of fun.
And then not fun.
Well, when it was time for me to leave, everything changed. So she never made it. We got married the week that 9/11 happened at the Justice of the Peace. So my parents were real thrilled about that. I called them on the way to the Justice of the Peace to let them know I was getting married. Yeah, and my best friend at the time was, he was my best man and my witness for that. And 3 months and 1 week later, we got divorced. So right before I moved to California, and I took off to California, spent a few months getting ready, and then deployed to Iraq. So that's kind of how all that started. But I grew up, you know, what is today probably a traditional growth. You know, it's like my parents got divorced. I bounced back and forth between their houses. I wasn't a very good kid. I was a horrible student. Never got in a lot of trouble. You know, I didn't do any drugs, but I drank a lot.
Yeah.
And you know, just kind of push the boundaries as much as I could at that point in my life.
So were you looking for God at all as a teenager? No. And like, so after y'all left the Church of Christ, it was...
Well, my best friend, his dad was the Methodist minister's son. So when we became friends, I started going to church at the Methodist Church in Frisco, Texas. But, you know, I was hanging out, playing basketball. I was a teenager. I didn't care. I got called out more than once in the service for not doing what I was supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when I left for boot camp, that was the last time I went to church for years.
Yeah.
Andrea is actually the reason that I came back to church.
Okay.
We tried a couple of times when we moved around a little bit, and I would visit a Church of Christ, but there was still no connection there. But right. That's the only thing I knew. And she grew up in a Pentecostal church.
Mm, I can see that.
Mm.
And I never could wrap my head around that. There wasn't any way that I was going that route. So we didn't go to church until we moved here. Mm. We tried a couple of different places, and a friend of mine told me, hey, you've got to try this place out. I think Travis was doing a series on why I can't believe in God.
Man, that one got me too. I listened to that one on the podcast or whatever, and it was solid.
So we started going to church. This would have been like in 2018, 2019.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And we went and we're here all the time and enjoyed it. And we were very quiet. And then when COVID happened, like a lot of people, I stopped going and I just didn't come back.
Mm-hmm.
And then I guess at the beginning of 23, Travis did the same sermon again.
I was about to say, because I remember it in 23. Okay.
So she had downloaded the app, and we were driving by, you know, because my whole world kind of revolved in this part. Said, hey, you know, this I Can't Believe in God series is coming back on. And we had been struggling. Not from our marriage standpoint necessarily. We were in a good place there, but my kids were in a really bad place.
Yeah.
Neither one of them believed in God.
Right.
You know, they didn't know God. They didn't, and I've always believed, but there was no relationship.
Right.
So my kids didn't believe at all. Mm. And that was a problem for both of us. So we talked to the kids and said, look, we want to go and do this series for 6 weeks. And at the end of 6 weeks, we'll visit. And if y'all want to continue going to church, we'll make this decision as a family. And if y'all are interested in continuing, we'll keep going. And if you're not, we'll stop. That's how little I had invested there. So every week after church, we'd be driving, you know, the mile and a half, 2 miles home. And we would talk about it and say, hey, well, how would y'all think today? Did you enjoy the service? And I asked them if they wanted to continue going, and they said yes, so we started going. And, you know, I think, like, I hate missing it. I hate not being here.
Yeah.
But still, I didn't know anybody at this church, like, not a soul.
And who was the first person that you knew here?
Oh, my. So, it's the craziest thing.
I know one day I walked in, and I was like, Jared, and you were like, you're like, nope. Don't talk to me.
I have to be honest, that's how I felt too. And it wasn't anything about you. It was just I'm a very private person. And I enjoyed being anonymous.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't have any problems. I'd been on the phone with my dad the week before, and he was involved in the Church of Christ and still is. And he was asking me about church, and I said, I love it. He goes, what do you love most about it? I said, I don't know a single person there. That's what I told him. And he goes, well, you like that? I went, yeah. And I said, we've been going for like 6 months, and I hadn't talked to anybody. He goes, nobody? I said, no. I just walked in. I go to the same seat that I always sit in. As soon as the service is up, we bolt, and we're gone. I said, I know the preacher's name. That's the only person I know. And not personally, I just can tell you what his name is.
And we talk to men that feel that like that. Yeah. I mean, there's definitely people that walk in and
that's all they want. That's all they
expect. Yeah, they're just like, hey, just let me be for a minute. Yeah. You know,
and that's good. And there's plenty of like areas where, you know, you maybe work in sales, you work with people, mm-hmm. you just want to go somewhere and unplug. Not be known, just switch out and listen. It's kind of like
the opposite of
Cheers, you
know? Yes, yeah. Where nobody knows your name.
Yeah, that's exactly what it was. So I have this long conversation with my dad about how great it is that I know nobody at this church, but I really enjoy going to it. And 3 days later, Travis calls me. Just out of the blue.
How do you have your number?
Well, yeah, signed up in the church app. You know, Andrea was in, you know, she does the signups and stuff. Yeah. And so, so he calls me, and, you know, I don't have his number, of course, but he's like, hey, this is Travis from church. I want to invite you out to lunch next week. Which was interesting. You know, I was like, well, that's kind of cool, right? Like, you know, I never talked to the preacher before, but we met over at El Charro and had lunch. And about 10 minutes into the lunch, I decided, you know, this is somebody I can be a friend with.
Yeah.
And I'm real upfront about everything. You know, I've smoked weed for 20 years. And we were 10 minutes in, and I finally stopped. I looked at him. I said, listen, I got to tell you something. I smoke weed every day. And he looked at me, and I go, I just have to get it out there because I'm not interested in becoming friends with somebody and then this coming up in 6 months and that being a problem costing me a friendship. So if it's an issue, we'll have lunch. That's great. And I'll be in your church on Sunday, but we don't have to be friends. Mm-hmm. And he didn't bat an eye. He didn't have any problems with it. He didn't say anything negative about it. He was real, you know, just accepting of the fact. And
but why is it that other church leaderships and other organizations, why is it that we get that feeling of fear that we're going to be judged for whatever it is? Well, you know,
because of traditions. I mean, I think we've all had it, whether it be at the schoolyard, in a church, as a child, you know.
Sure. But I mean, I think it's based on, you know, history, truth.
Oh, yeah,
you know,
well, truth. For me,
I mean, that's what you're hitting it because of what's happened, right?
Yeah.
So, but that's not the message that I get when I read the red letters.
Right. No. That's not the letter.
But I had never
you see
read
what I mean?
I had never read the red letters.
I feel you on that, but I'm just saying, like, that's a why I'm offended.
Yeah.
You know, when a police car gets behind me, I feel resentful that I'm worried because, you know, I'm not breaking the law. I'm not doing anything wrong, you know, and I see pictures and videos of, like, police in Europe, you know, they're like, wearing, like, safety vests and, like, they're clearly police and, like, their cars are marked with chartreuse letters. Oh, yeah. And, like, the police here, like, in White House, you know, it's all black on black. They're hiding in daylight, you know, they're sneaking in.
It's a different mentality.
It's the same way. It's like I hear a lot of backlash. You know, I see it. I watch a lot of videos and shorts and stuff of people preaching in the street. And, you know, you get
somebody who gets mad at the preacher out there.
You get the rainbow coalitions out there screaming at them and stuff. You know, you're a hateful person. You're a bigot. You know, I'm like, well, we shouldn't be.
Right.
You know, and like if that's what they're getting, then we're doing it wrong.
Well, remember, my mother was excommunicated from the church because she got divorced.
He had experience.
And I'm going, look, if I do something wrong, they have no problem sending me to hell.
Yeah.
So,
but I appreciate that you felt the pressure. You were like, hey, I kind of like this guy. You're like, let me just get this out of the way.
Absolutely.
You know, because as a man, that's a big deal. Mm-hmm. You know, like if you're going to open up and actually be friends with somebody, there's got to be a fair amount of trust and respect in that relationship. And I think your willingness to lay things on the table and go, hey, here's where I'm at. Right. And I think me too, that's why I'm still here. Mm-hmm. And that's why I think the three of us are at this particular church.
Without a doubt.
That you can even try to do that at.
Yeah.
I've only tell you, message me, I'll tell you where they are. You know,
I'm staying here.
I found the two churches that won't go, get him, you know, yeah, there it is, get him, you know.
But that, you know, that is a true feeling for a lot of people, is if they admit to their sin at the church, that the church isn't going to be accepting any longer. Mm-hmm. You know, I went to a church where if you go, hey, how are you doing? Everybody's good. And for me, at every moment in my life that was super fucked up, the church was the last place that I would go to because I don't need more judgment. I've got plenty of that in my own head.
Right.
Yeah, but like, I guess that's what I'm getting at. It's like, God is our Father.
I mean,
so you follow me this, right? So with my kids, they know that if they ever get in trouble, whether they do it and it's their fault or something, whatever, if they're in a bad spot, I'm the first person. I'm the first phone call. I'll show up with a gun, a flashlight, a shovel,
whatever,
a cell phone, whatever we need to do. Like, I have you,
absolutely,
whether it's your fault or not, right? And I think God wants that with us.
Yeah,
but people have organized religion in such a way that we're all like, well, I don't want to tell God or his people about this. But that's what he calls us to do. It says, confess your sins to one another and to me. So how do we mix that up?
Because you have, I guess over time, is if you're moving towards some level of sanctification in your own head, even if it's the wrong direction, you put yourself kind of in a holier-than-thou position. So if you see people doing stuff that's wrong, you've got to kind of let them know that they're wrong. And a lot of times what they need is somebody to go, hey, it's okay. We take broken people. You don't have to fix yourself before you come to Jesus.
Yeah, that's another deal. It's like, I'm like, hey, I don't fix myself at all. I'm not really I'm the arbiter of other people's behaviors or decisions either, especially if they're not in my household. And I don't put the burden of fixing anybody on myself. I used to be a counselor, and, you know, you had to have a boundary there.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm always like, step away from yourself, you know, like put yourself down, you know, and step away, because that's God's business.
I agree.
But it's funny because you were really isolated. This perception of things had isolated you. It pushed you out.
I tell you, I did not have one friend. Not one.
Not at all.
None. My wife is my closest confidant and we've been married 20 years this year. And she was the only friend I had. Mm-hmm. Now I had acquaintances.
Yeah.
I had people that I would say hi to if we ran into each other. I'd met enough people through my, you know, careers here in Tyler.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I met you at New York Life. I remember when I came in to do my paperwork, you were like, you and I are the most tattooed people out of the world. Like, I didn't believe you because you were in a suit.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't really believe the suit either.
No. and I will never put a suit on again for the rest of my life, hey, I have to be honest.
I bet you will. When your daughter gets married, I bet you put a suit on.
If she asks me to, I might. But
She strikes me as like the human that's going to be like, Daddy, you got to wear this suit.
Yeah, well, for her, there's not a whole lot I wouldn't do.
Right. Never say never, baby.
Given any choice, like, I'm going to be buried in shorts and a t-shirt. I'm going to be cremated. I'm not going to be buried at all. But if I were, I'm like shorts and a t-shirt. If I'm going to spend eternity in it, I'm not having a tie on. That's crazy.
Yeah.
But, you know, we had a great lunch. It was, you know, we said about an hour, and then 2.5 hours later, we're still sitting there at El Charo's, and I was like, man, this guy is real, all the way through, and somebody that I really just was able to connect to. And I started hanging out with him, and he started telling me about Freedom Weekend. Now, at the time, things were going pretty well in my life. You know, I didn't have an outside, you know, circle of men that I could go to, and I was very isolated, but, you know, my marriage was in a good place, and my business was doing pretty well. My kids were not, but I didn't see that as something that...
As an essential.
Right. Yeah. That was like, I didn't need outside influence.
They'll
figure that shit out. So, and we were working with them, of course, but I didn't have outside influences helping there. And then Travis just started inviting me to things and introducing me to people. And I met more people in the 6 months from that lunch than I had met in the last 5 years.
Yeah.
And it was difficult, I have to be honest. It had been so long since I had been out trying to introduce myself or trying to meet people.
Well, I mean, coming from that same universe, I just want to say that, like, New York Life had great training, and I enjoyed the stuff I did with them, but it sucked the soul out of me, because it's easier to turn a prospect into a friend and a client than it is to turn a friend into a client.
Oh, yeah.
And I lost a lot of friends that I thought I had the moment I started calling them and talking about insurance. Mm-hmm. And then I couldn't ever turn it off. And I, like, in hindsight, I see my dad was a CLU and he was a producer. And, like, you know, we couldn't go to the airport and get on an airplane to go on vacation. And he's like the guy next to him, hey, what do you do for work? You know, I mean, the elevator talk was coming, you know, and I knew it, and I knew how he said the things, and it got that way with me. I couldn't go to a sporting event, have dinner with friends that I didn't know without having to tell them. You have to tell them. You have to talk to them, see if you can get an appointment, see if you can talk about life insurance. And I'm back in insurance now and have purposefully not talked about insurance with my friends, with my closest friends. And I would say that I've been burnt because I did have close friends when I was with New York Life that I was trying to work with. I sold one of them a policy. One of them didn't ever get one. They both died. You know, and so that burn coupled with, like, the people quit answering your phone call. You're just calling to see if you want to have dinner. And they're like, no, nah, he's going to be talking about insurance again.
Yeah.
So, like, getting thrown, going from that
to
a situation where, like, you know, you met Travis. Travis is introducing you to genuine people that actually love God and just care about you, want to be your friend.
Absolutely.
But it still feels like, it just, that industry's kind of ruined me on that.
It was tough. And I had already left New York life when I started coming to Wilderness and started our business.
You were doing tattoo removal?
Tattoo removal. My wife was doing laser hair removal, and we were just trying to, you know, trying to survive. But, you know, we started in, you know, at the end of, 2018.
Okay.
And the economy was fantastic, and it was easy to make money, everything. And we did pretty well for a while, and with the, you know, all the stimulus money that they pushed into it, we picked up as much of that as we could, but that dried up real quickly, and there was nothing left. So, 23, I meet Travis. Things are going real well. I become more connected in the church. He tells me about Freedom Weekend. I'm excited. Like, as soon as he tells me, I'm doing this, this is awesome, because the people I'm meeting are really great people. And everything was really great right up until the week of Freedom Weekend. And then the Monday of Freedom Weekend, I had to close my business permanently. And
what happened?
I just ran out of money. You know, we had been struggling for a few months. The economy had just kind of come to a grinding halt. Mm-hmm. We had, when I opened our business, we had virtually no competition anywhere in Tyler. There were like four other places. And then you had all of these traveling nurses that had been making money for the last 2-3 years that were coming back, and they realized they didn't have to work in the hospital system anymore, and they could go and get Botox certified and all these different fillers and injectors. And then the next thing you know, I had 22 competitors in Tyler. And the services that they were offering, my services were the ones they were giving away free to get people in their doors. And 3 months of not making enough to cover the, you know, the nut, so to speak, and we got to a place where it's coming up on the 1st of October, and like, I have to make payroll, I have to make rent, and I have to pay this payment, which is, you know, for the loan, which is massive, and there wasn't enough money to do all three of them. And so we thought we had worked out a situation where it was going to be okay, and there was a, you know, paperwork snafu or something at the bank, and it didn't work out. So I called the bank to let them know it was over. They told me they would give me an extension of the loan, but I had to go and put my house up as collateral for it. And I'm going, yeah, I can't be homeless.
Yeah.
So we closed it on that Monday, and it was terrible. It was one of the most difficult decisions I've ever had to make.
Monday of Freedom Week?
Monday of Freedom Week. And I called Travis, and I said, I'm not going. I remember I started crying on Tuesday, and I'm going, I don't remember the last time I cried. And I couldn't stop. I was just distraught. I didn't know what I was supposed to do. I had this massive loan that I couldn't pay back. There was no end in sight all of a sudden. And I was telling Travis, you don't want me there. Like, whatever happens at this thing, because, you know, they don't tell us anything.
Right.
I was like, I'm going to screw it up. Like, y'all have some goal, I'm assuming. Like, there's got to be something that y'all are trying to get out of this. And I'm going to mess this up. And he said, look, you're the right guy for this. You need to be there. And
yeah, he told me. He was like, hey, there's a guy that's, like, really going through. So I didn't know it was you.
Yeah.
And so, I was like, do we need to go out and get him and bring him, you know?
Well, I have to tell you, so Friday, you know, I'm supposed to be here at 6 p.m. for this, and it's like 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and I look at Andrew, and I'm going, I'm not going. Like, I'm not going. It's 4 p.m. I got to leave in like an hour and a half. And she looked at me, and she goes, well, you need to go. She said, but whether you go there or not, you can't stay here tonight. And, you know, we didn't have any money, so I couldn't get a hotel room. So I came up here very begrudgingly, and it was a transformational weekend for me. It changed my life. So, you know, it was a very difficult time, and it took several weeks for us to get to a spot where I even thought we'd be able to make it forward at all. We lost our house in the process. And then not lost like the bank took it, but I couldn't afford to have it anymore. I couldn't afford to pay the bills, and I had enough equity built up in it that I knew we could get by if I could sell it. And so we put it on the market. We closed at the beginning of October. By Thanksgiving, we had moved out of it. It took several months to actually sell it. We didn't sell it until April of 24. But, I lost everything. Mm-hmm. And started over worse than scratch because I still had this massive amount of debt there.
For the laser?
For the lasers, yeah. So like $250,000.
That's crazy.
Yeah, so it was a really difficult time period. And here I am with two teenagers and a wife, and we both worked for the business, so neither one of us had a job. And just kind of had a breakdown.
Yeah.
It was a real difficult time for me. But because of Freedom Weekend, I had met enough men that when I walked into church on Sunday morning, that they would come up and say hi. Like, Pat, you and mm-hmm. I had a breakthrough up top. I broke down in the coffin upstairs, right?
We're going to have to cut that.
I know. I have to tell you, I was the first one up the stairs. They had asked Pat to pray for all the men coming through this, and Pat was afraid of praying out loud.
Yeah.
Right? Like, so
terrified.
He tells me as I get up there, he's like, man, I'm really nervous about this. And I'm going, you're nervous about this. Look what I have to do. But we visited. He had a great prayer, and I've heard him pray so many times from the stage now, and he's come so far on that. But that weekend really changed my life and kind of embedded me in this church to where I'll never leave as long as this church is here.
Couldn't run me off with a shit-covered stick.
Yeah, I'm in it for the long haul. Mm-hmm. But, that was 18 months ago to 19 months ago now, and... You know, we're still dealing with the fallout. It's not like I've made $250,000 to give the bank back. So, we have all those problems still looming. There's no doubt. But my life has grown so much in the last 18, 19 months that I don't think I've ever been in a better place than I currently am.
Yeah.
And it's because of the friendships. It's because, I think... Well, there's probably 50 men I could call, and they would be there to help me. I've probably got 8 or 9 men I could call that I would really trust.
Yeah.
Where I'm going, these men know me.
Mm-hmm.
They know what I've been through. They, they're not offended by it. They don't judge me for it. It's a definitely a life-changing event. So, but we started going here. My daughter ended up getting baptized by Travis. Mm-hmm. Now my son got baptized about a month and a half ago.
Yeah.
This church has made all the difference in our life. Mm. But I didn't go to church on a regular basis until we found this one. Mm. And
well, when do you think you were saved?
I was baptized when I was a kid.
Yeah.
And because it was a thing to do. And once again, it's never been a matter of belief. The idea that there is no God to me is so difficult to follow.
Ridiculous.
I'm like, there's so much more faith involved in believing that we came from nothing than believing we came from a creator.
Have you read that book?
Probably not.
It's what is it? It's I don't have enough faith to be an atheist.
No, but I should look that one up.
It got recommended to me last summer by Jared, who hadn't read it. Probably still hasn't read it.
Different
thanks, Jared Hill.
Yeah, different. Yeah,
not this guy.
Yeah.
Because, Michelle's trying to work through this stuff. And so we listened to it between here and, Portland, but we had a pit stop in San Francisco. So, we drove in the car, we listened to this book, and I was into it, dude. It was talking about physics and science, and it was like trying to get into this stuff, and that's not what she's struggling with,
right.
I mean, whatever it was in that book, but it was really interesting, I mean, it went into like what atheists believe we come from, from nothing. So then what happens when you die? Nothing.
Welcome to your creator.
It's like, when has anything of intelligence or life come from nothing?
Mm-hmm.
Never. It just doesn't work that way. So it jumped way into the science behind it, and I thought it was brilliant. And the two guys that wrote it are big deal apologists.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of them was an atheist and then converted or got
is
saved.
Is it Frank?
Frank.
I know who you're talking about. Dude, that dude is freaking
both of those guys. And they go back and forth, so it was tough to listen to because, I think if you read it on paper, like you can tell who's talking, you know, because they switch narration some.
Okay.
But it was, I would say, you know, now that we're recommending a book, like I would recommend anybody read it, especially if you do believe, because it filled in some gaps for me where I know that like I wasn't equipped before. But like if I was talking to somebody about faith now and they were like, yeah, but this, you know, I'd be like, but have you thought about, you know, it gave me the answer to questions I didn't have. Yeah. And that's been an interesting thing I want to ask you, because I'm the same way. I don't know that I ever really thought that God didn't exist. I think I got to a place, you know, when I was using drugs where I thought I knew I couldn't quit. And I knew that I needed help quitting. And I asked God and I prayed and I would just drink anyway. And I got to a place where I was like, well, God probably does exist, but like either he doesn't care about me or he isn't going to help me.
Yeah.
That's where I got. And see, somebody told me that's kind of maybe more of an agnostic viewpoint. Yeah.
Right.
I was hook, line, sinker on Discovery Channel, on History Channel, on National Geographic.
And yeah, it's got to be true, right?
They perpetuated that towards me as a teenager. You know, the Earth is billions of years old. We have all the evidence in the world. Mm-hmm. And then now that, you know, I've looked past all of their outright lies, in my opinion, I don't think it's a matter of... Well, maybe it is. Okay, so they've perpetuated the idea so much that it's gotten ingrained all through society. And they don't realize that the person who parked the car before them was wrong. Will you stop? Bro. They don't realize the person who parked the car before them parked it out of place also. So you've just got this domino of
yeah, I don't know that down. All of them are evil intention.
Yeah, exactly.
But, you know,
they were taught the same thing.
Though. If it's follow the leader, right. The person that they followed, who they don't even know, they're not even aware. It's just like the Planned Parenthood. You know, we had that episode. It's like the lady that started it was like, let's kill all the undesirables.
Right.
You know? And like now, the undesirables...
Is everyone.
They're like, hey, my body, my choice. You know, they're out there like campaigning for their own ability to abort their own legacies.
That,
you know?
That you've literally been tricked by the person who wants you dead.
And I think that happens a lot in our society on every aspect, whether it's religious or just what, you know, my disillusionment of the government and how they run things.
You would have had a front row seat to it all.
Absolutely. So, you know, there's a lot of learning curve for me, but, you know, I came to this church with a youth group understanding of the Bible.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I had never learned anything past that. I like that. Mm-hmm. And
you can get pretty far with a youth group understanding.
Not mine.
Hey, I think you can't, you know, look, Dr. Blom came and he said, our pastors at our planted churches, at our tent churches, have a youth group understanding of the gospel. Mm-hmm. You know? And so, like, I guess that's my deal. Like, our job in discipleship is to develop and equip other leaders, right? Absolutely. I mean, that's what we've realized. Like, if you're a believer and you come to church, you're in ministry.
Yeah.
You might not be full-time ministry. You don't get paid for it, but it's your job to be in ministry. And people are watching you, you know? And Blom's like, hey, if you've got a youth group understanding, like, you've heard the gospel.
Yes.
You know enough to help somebody else. Come teach
some people.
And that was the problem, is I couldn't answer any questions. Like, I had a belief there, and I understood that Jesus had died for me, and then because of me even. But if somebody asked me to articulate any aspect of that, it wasn't going to go well. I couldn't answer any theological questions. I couldn't go in any depth. I still, to this day, can't tell you any scriptures off the top of my head.
You can answer questions.
I can answer
questions. I had lunch with you on Wednesday, and we jumped in a little deep on some stuff. And
well, that's a part of the journey after the discipleship really started at Freedom Weekend.
Without a doubt.
But then I know you were like, you know what? I don't understand this thing. I'm just going to sit down and read it. Like, what's the worst that can happen type thing?
I don't read much, but I listened to the Bible, at least the New Testament, for the first time last year on a tractor while I was mowing. Yep. So I'd get on the tractor to go mow and throw my headphones on and just hit start on my Bible app, which I picked which version of the Bible app by who the narrator was, like, if I could understand them. I tried to listen to the King James Version. It sounded like a Monty Python type movie.
I love Monty Python. I can listen to Monty Python over and over.
So, but, you know, that's where I started getting my education there. You know, I missed church a few weeks ago for no reason. Mm-hmm. And just because I didn't feel like going. I woke up in a bad mood. And the rest of my week, I felt like there was something missing for me.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I was disappointed that was the decision I made. As the, you know, faith leader of my house, that I allowed that to happen.
Yeah.
Just because I was tired and mm-hmm. I was cranky. So, you know, this has been quite a journey for me as I've gone through this process to become closer to God and to start to understand that I don't have to fix myself because I can't. There's a reason I didn't ever go to church, because I was like, well, I'm still all messed up. You know, mm-hmm. I still do all these bad things. I still drink too much, or I smoke weed, or, you know, for a long time looked at pornography or whatever it was. Mm-hmm. And I didn't understand that God could fix all of those things once I started coming to Him with them. I thought I had to handle that on my own.
Yeah.
So, that's how I ended up here, and now, you know, I don't have any friends that don't go to this church, and if I do, I invite them here.
Yeah. Well,
do you think you got saved when you were baptized when you were a kid?
No, I got saved at Freedom Weekend. Mm. I'd been baptized before, and I understood that, you know, I could still answer that question. I do believe that Jesus Christ is my Lord and Savior, and that was easy for me to answer my entire life. It was just, you know, it was kind of like the lost landlord type thing. You know, like, I have to send some rent in every once in a while. Yeah. But, you know, I've never met the guy.
You woke up from Freedom Weekend.
It truly was a life-changing event.
I think it was my first Freedom Weekend here. Mm-hmm. I think I was on the team.
Yeah.
No, you were on the team with my first Freedom Weekend. And I was on the one before you.
Okay. Yeah. That makes sense.
That's right. Yeah, it was my second one then.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, you did a great job as the MC the next one.
Oh, that's cool.
I loved that.
Yeah.
That was two or three after, I think.
That was two of them ago,
yeah.
So, but that was the big moment for me, was going through Freedom Weekend and, one, learning that I'm not the only broken man. Because my whole life, everybody had put on this facade that life would, you know, they come in their Sunday best and their shoes are shined and they've got their tie on. And, you know, I show up and I'm going, man, if these people only knew how messed up I was, they would never let me in this building again. Mm-hmm. And then I walk in this building and I go, everybody in here's messed up.
Yeah.
And they're all still moving in the right direction. Mm-hmm. Not to mention everybody looks like me. So it's very helpful. I don't feel like an outcast. That's it. So, but that was my walk. You know, I had tried a couple of times through my life to go to church, but never could fit in. You know, I tried to join the softball team into church. And, you know, they'd go play, and then after, I'd be like, hey, you want to go grab a beer or something? And they would look at me like I'd lost my damn mind. So, you know, this has been probably the best thing that's ever happened for my family, without a doubt. It saved my daughter. She was going down a really dark path. She had struggled tremendously going through middle school. You know, the indoctrination that just happens in public schools is always around you. So she had struggled with her identity. She had struggled with her sexuality. She had struggled with, like, to a point where it was causing physical problems for her. Mm. And this church is what brought her out of that. And she's flourished and has had an incredible high school career, and she graduates, you know, in a few weeks and is going to college.
Both of our daughters.
Yeah, that's right.
So, yeah, how was prom?
She looked beautiful. She got grounded for being late.
You know what? I told my daughter, I said, don't worry about coming home. Here's $150. Have fun. Don't get pregnant. Don't go to jail. If you do either of those, call me, you know?
Yeah, I told my daughter, I said, I'll give you till 1 o'clock. Don't be a minute later. You're grounded. And then she was late, and I'm going,
you've tied my
hands. I already told
here.
You what happened. Now I can't do anything about it. So.
Yeah.
But, you know,
tell her I said to give her a break.
I'll let her know.
She can sing, dude.
She can. She is very talented.
She can sing. So can your wife. I've noticed. She'd be singing on TikTok.
She's good.
I was getting down, dude. She was singing Alanis Morissette or something. I was like, that's what's up. I bet your wife was a fun time 20 years ago. Not that she's not fun now, but like, wow. I feel like I also would be like, what up? Let's party.
It was wild.
When did you and your wife meet?
Oh, all right. So...
First, he's got to talk about how he ended up back home because he was deployed.
Yes.
Yeah, that's kind of...
All right, so I guess it was 21 years ago, as we had known each other for about a year when we got married. But I had been in Iraq. It was my second deployment, and we had been out on deployment one of the evenings. It was April 6th of 2005. We had been out for like 3 or 4 days on patrol and running a checkpoint outside of Fallujah. It was during the first Battle of Fallujah.
My brother was in Fallujah.
Yeah, that is a shitty place to be.
Yeah.
You know, they had those contractors that got caught in Fallujah and got strung up on the bridge and they burned them to death and all that. And there was this huge, you know, prompt, go in and take this city. You know, it's time. Now, we had already been planning to go into Fallujah and take it, but it was 4 or 5 months down the road.
Yeah.
And when all that happened, they just moved everything forward. So my detachment, we ran this personal security detachment. We had augmented with about 30 other Marines. And we went out, about 5 clicks outside of the city on the cloverleaf, just outside of it, to kind of manage traffic. So our helicopters went through and dropped pamphlets and had speakers going off saying, hey, in 3 days we're going to come in, and if you're here, you're an enemy combatant and we're going to kill you. So if you don't want to be a part of that, get the hell out. And for 3 days we watched cars just shoot out of the city. They'd drive by and whatnot, and then every once in a while you'd have cars driving into the city,
right? Yeah.
Like, so there, those guys are going, all right, we'll play this game with you. And we just let them go, you know, like, well, we'll see you in 3 days.
That's crazy.
So I mean, we didn't know why. Maybe they're going to pick up their grandmother or something.
Maybe they were thinking the Russians tried this before.
Yeah, I know.
Good luck.
Figured it out. So,
but Fallujah was in Iraq, right?
Yeah.
So I guess the Russians didn't try it.
They did in Afghanistan, and we screwed that up really badly too, actually.
Yeah.
but
I agree.
So we were sat out there, and
because I was all about those wars, you know. I graduated 2003, so like I watched the second plane fly into the building, and I was like, we should make a parking lot for Israel over there. Let's just flatten the whole building. We can pave it.
Yeah,
they probably put big signs.
It would have been cheaper.
100% would have been cheaper. But, you know, and then when they didn't find any weapons of mass destruction, and then I started digging probably in the 2010s. And I realized that, like, there was two countries that didn't have, you know, fractional banking, you know? Like, they didn't have our banking system.
Yeah. Iraq and Libya?
Mm-hmm.
And Afghanistan.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so, like, you know, I'm looking at that. I'm going...
It was all for money.
It was oil and banking.
All for money.
It was oil and banking. And how many countless lives did we, you know, I mean, North Korea is the last holdout now. You know, everybody else has it. So we've screwed everybody.
And they don't have any good things in North Korea. So we're not.
Yeah, there's no minerals there,
I guess.
Mm-hmm. Maybe they all know Taekwondo, so we can't go in there. And they might karate chop us or something.
We need the teachers.
Oh, when you're pissing off your only ally of China, you've got a bad deal going.
Yeah.
So.
Anyway, sorry. So, back. So you're outside of Fallujah.
So we're outside of Fallujah, and then we get pushed back because I had an idiot for a commanding officer.
It happens. No. It happens.
He was a metal chaser.
Yeah.
Right? Like, he had been an intel agent or something, and never, you know, sometimes people just go because they want, you know, prestige, I guess. I don't know what it is.
Experience.
Promotions. You know, the only way you get promoted at that level, if you're, you know, a colonel, is to be able to put on your resume that you've done something like that.
Yeah.
So we got pushed back to this little town we drove through, and this was a very unfriendly town. You could tell as you drove through, the women and children would go in, and the men would walk out of the houses.
Mm-hmm.
And you're looking going, yeah, this isn't going to work out real well for us. So they put us out on this bridge, and we had been there for about 12 hours, and at dark, they attacked us, mortar rounds and all kinds of stuff. And I was standing, I don't know, about 12, 15 feet away from where a mortar round hit. And I got peppered with shrapnel, and my captain, who is to this day one of my good friends still, because of this and, you know, the event, he got hit in the neck with shrapnel, and we had to medevac him out. We had Marines that didn't make it, and it was just a rough night. And I can say that was probably one of the most difficult nights for me, because I lost my ability to command that night in my head. I lost my temper, and was really, really ready to go commit war crimes. Mm-hmm. We saw where the mortars came from. They opened up with small arms fire and RPGs and that type of thing. And with the captain gone, that put me kind of in charge of the Marines that were out there. You know, I had some auxiliary Marines that had come in, but they didn't have the platoon, right? Like, they had an air officer who was a major at the time, and he was talking to the birds that were flying above. And I called my squad. I was like, we're going across this field to that mosque, because we knew where the mortars had come from. I said, and we're going into that mosque, and we're going to kill every son of a bitch in there, right? Which is no doubt a war crime. Yeah. Right? You're not allowed to do 100%. That. And I'm angry. I don't have any pants on, right? Like, not because I didn't bring them out there, but right. I got peppered with shrapnel and I'm bleeding. So my doc, his call sign was Superman. So Superman, if you're out there, I still appreciate you. he cut my cami bottoms off and patched me. So I've got my body armor on and no pants.
G.I. Joe action figure people, if you're listening, these like action figure things. So we need a Jared Stevens.
Make me
doll.
Atomically correct, please. So I've got my squad together. I'm like, look, we're going across this field. It's probably 300 yards, 400 yards across. And I said, and we're going in that mosque and we're going to burn the son of a bitch down. Like, kill everybody inside. I don't care. They had already taken out a warehouse that they had small arms fire from. And thank God for Lieutenant Colonel Jamie Cox, who was a major at the time. He said, my call sign was Shady.
Of course.
Yeah,
of course.
I know. He said, Shady, you can't go do that. And I looked at him, I'm like, who the fuck do you think you are to tell me what I can and can't do? This is my platoon. And he said, you don't understand. We have birds up in the air, and they can't tell the difference between you and the men. You have to stay here. Fortunately, I wasn't so angry that wouldn't connect with me. I understood the dangers of that. And I didn't go, thankfully, or I would have gone to jail. Mm-hmm. And, you know, 24 hours later, we were back on base. My captain was fine, which was good.
And you have pants.
And and there were pants there, which was helpful. And the worst part about it is, you know, it destroyed my dinner that I was trying to heat up for the first time. I was going to have a hot meal in like 3.5 days. And the mortar round ripped my food out of my hand and splattered it all over the freaking barrier behind me. You know, it was a really difficult time for me. You know, it was a very eye-opening moment. And we had some firefights and battles as we had, you know, gone and done other things. But that one hit real close to home for me. So they awarded me the Purple Heart, and that was not something I wanted. I wasn't wounded real badly. Right. It was more of a psychological issue. You know, shrapnel sucks, but I wasn't bleeding out on the side of the road. I didn't leave. And I had had some extracurricular activities while I was in Iraq. I was running the alcohol for the base, which is against the rules, it turns out.
Lucrative.
Yeah.
Lucrative business.
Hence my call sign, Shady. It wasn't lucrative financially. It was lucrative for our team. So my team was the one that went out when we weren't supposed to go out. We were the ones that went and did things that really weren't on the docket. And if I needed Humvees with up armor, I could call the master sergeant in charge of the motor pool because, well, he liked Jameson's, and I could get it. So I would drop off bottles of liquor to people or Heineken to my sergeant major, and you know, they would just allow me to do whatever I wanted to.
Is there a statute of limitations on this?
No, they already got me. So there's okay. Jeopardy at this point.
Gotcha.
Yeah, they already know about it.
Yeah, okay, good.
They wrote a book about it. But
Did they really?
Yeah.
They Shut really did. Up.
What's it called?
No. So
it's public information. I'm going to figure this out.
You can figure it out. Look it up. But things kind of went downhill from that. My unit was rotating out. I'd already signed up for another turn at this. So my guys were all going back to the States, and I was supposed to stay for another 8-9 months.
Because you were, like, divorced, and you were on the... So I guess to rewind, because we filled a bunch of space. Yeah. So you had gotten married, deployed, gotten divorced.
Almost.
And then, well, you were done.
Yes.
And then they were like, you got married because you were going to deploy, and then you deployed.
Right. So I got
married. So you're on this deployment. You were technically months away from being fully not done. Having to go.
Yeah.
You were done with your reserve time, right?
Well, so
they called you back
yeah,
in.
So we got married because I was going to take her with me, but then that fell apart real quick because it was a really horrible decision to make. And she never left. And I had gone through a whole deployment in Iraq. And she was still technically my wife, but we hadn't been together in quite some time. And I was running all the alcohol, and I had a pretty set rule of not drinking, right? Like, this was for me to get things that I needed without red tape, right? Like, it made it real easy for me to get anything we needed for my platoon. And I just kind of said, you know, that's part of the deal. I can't drink this. That's for other things. But after that, I was kind of on my own. And we had a lot of command change. And the colonel that was in charge had left, and a new colonel had come in. And over a woman. There's some firefighter chick that was out there, and we borrowed a fire truck, and she got drunk, and then there was a fire, and she couldn't go and put it out because she was hammered, and it all came back to me. The borrowing the fire truck was a problem, it turns out.
What were y'all doing with the fire truck?
Somebody told me that they didn't think that I would be able to drive it. I can drive anything that has wheels. I'm like, fuck you, I'll show you. And this is alcohol-induced. It wasn't like... I wasn't trying to borrow a fire truck. It was just kind of one of those bets.
Were you dating this firefighter chick?
No, I can't remember her name. But I thought that it would be fun to kind of get over some of my misery if I could date her for at least that day. And
drop the fire truck.
That's what we were doing with the fire truck. I got it.
So, and we didn't. I want to let you know that she got way too drunk, and then when the fire broke out and they called her and she couldn't go on duty, that's kind of where it all came down.
Oh, that sucks.
So, you know, I got in a lot of trouble, and I was up for promotion, and they canceled the promotion, and then they busted me down a rank, so I lost a lot of money, and really kind of tarnished my reputation, because, you know, I was never a great Marine. Like, I was the Marine you wanted there at war, but if we were back in the States, you probably shouldn't hang out with me, because you're most likely to get in trouble. You know, the Marine Corps and all the military, you start at 7:30 in the morning, you get like an hour and a half for lunch, and then you're done at 4:30 in the afternoon. And you give me from 4:30 till 7:30 the next day, I will find some trouble to get into. Mm. So when we were deployed, I was great to have around. I was very resourceful and could make things happen. But, you know, I'd been in trouble before. I think I got promoted or demoted 9 times throughout my career.
That's impressive.
Yeah, man. I went to a lot of places.
Yeah.
So I get in trouble. They bust me down. I'm in a horrible place mentally. My friends, the people that I trusted with my life, have all rotated. I've got a whole new group of these Green Marines. That, you know, some of them are metal hunters and some of them are just terrified. But none of them had been out there. And this is now my third turn. So they sent me home for 2 weeks. Get my head right. I got on an airplane, flew from Kuwait City back to the States, landed at DFW, and I had 2 weeks at home. So a couple of days in, I'd been spending with my mom and my dad there, over to Nate's house. He lived in Denton, Texas. And he's like, so what do you want to do tonight? And I said, I got 3 things that I want to pull off. I want to get drunk, right, because this is needed at this point. And I want to get in a fight, and I want to get laid. Like, if we can pull off all 3 of those things, it's been a good night. And
it's
I have
a hat trick.
Yeah. And I only got 1 of them. I got hammered. But not for lack of trying. I want to let you know that I went all out that night. But that's the night I met Andrea. So we went to this pool hall in Denton called Dusty's. I don't even know if it's still there anymore. But I'm throwing darts with Nate. His wife is there with us. And Andrea walks in the bar. And Jess, Nate's wife, says, "Jared, you need to go talk to her." And I said, "When I'm done with this game, I will." And she goes, "No, I need another drink. Go get me a drink and go talk to her." So I walked up, and Andrea had gone into, oh, shit, it is still there. There, baby. There you go. Well, shout out to Dusty's. Thank you very much for introducing me to my wife.
We got to go.
Absolutely. It's a dive. I mean, I have to be honest. It's kind of a shithole. But look, I'm still married to the woman, so it can't be that bad. But I go up to talk to her, and she walked up between the waitress rails. And, you know, because what I didn't know at the time is her best friend was the bartender. So I walk up to her to talk to her, but before I got there, some really drunk guy, I wasn't drunk yet, some really drunk guy had walked up and grabbed the rails. So it essentially trapped her in between him and the bar. But he's really intoxicated. Mm-hmm. I tap him on his shoulder, and he can't just turn around and look at me. He's got to let go of one of the rails to turn. So when he did, I stepped in between him and her and just kind of like snugged up at the bar with her. And I'm like, "Hey, how's it going? My name's Jared." And she was obviously uncomfortable because this guy was behind her. You know, mm-hmm. he had put her in a rough spot. And then here's me. And I look odd, right? Like, I've been in the desert for months. Mm. I weigh 160 pounds at most.
Golly.
I mean, there's not a lot of food. And so I'm like, "Hey, how's it going?" You know, whatever. And this guy taps me on the shoulder. And he goes, "Hey, I was talking to her." And I go, "Oh, well, she wants to talk to me, not to you, so go away." And I turn back around. He taps me on the shoulder again. And he said, "I said I was talking to her." And I looked at him and said, as I'm thinking, this is my opportunity,
this
right?
This is like, the fight.
This
yeah.
is my fight. This yep. is fantastic. And it's going to happen next to a woman, right? This could work out.
Exactly.
So I turn around, I'm looking at him and said, "Buddy, if you want to go outside, I mean, we can. But I will let you know, I killed better men than you last week. And if we go outside, I'm going to break your neck and leave your dead body in the street. And I'm going to come back in here and finish my beer like it never happened." I said, "Or I'll buy you a beer, but you got to choose right now." And he goes, "I'll have a Bud Light." So I turned to Erica, the bartender, and I'm like, "Hey, put a Bud Light on his tab for me." And
on his tab.
So, you know, put it on my tab. So she hands me a Bud Light. I hand it to this dude, and he goes away. I don't know who he is. I don't see him again. I don't know him. And this is my chance. I'm like, shit, I didn't get in a fight because he decided he wanted a beer instead. And maybe I went on a little strong. You know, I could have pulled that a little back a little bit and accomplished the fight. But I'd introduce myself, and I'm like, "Hey, you know, I haven't had a drink in a long time." She's like, "Did you just get out of prison?" I'm like, "I didn't think this through very well." And I'm like, "No, I've been in Iraq, and I'd love for you to come and sit and visit with me. I've got a table over there." And she goes, "Maybe I'll stop by." I didn't know. She knew, like, everybody in the bar because her best friend's the bartender. She goes there quite often. So every time I try and talk to Andrea for the rest of the night, her best friend does what best friends do. You know, it's her job to make sure Andrea doesn't go home with me. Mm-hmm. That's it. So I would start talking to her, and then Erica would call her over. So finally I walked up to the bar, and I said, "Erica, I want to buy a round for the bar." "Now, this is a pool hall. There's a lot of people here." And she goes, "Well, what do you want to buy them?" I said, "Fuck if I know. You're going to have to go ask them." So for the next hour and a half...
She's busy.
She doesn't have time to stop.
That's so good.
I talked to Andrea for a while, and she was cool and, you know, and an interesting person to get to know, but not real interested in me. And I ended up getting her phone number. That's all you get. And I still have the little matchbook that she wrote her phone number in. And so I left drunk, but by myself, and without getting in a fight that night, and spent like $2,500 on the bar tab. Yeah. It was an expensive. Oh. Now, you have to understand, I'd been in Iraq.
Exactly.
It's not like a convenience store you can go to out there. Yeah. So, you know, you just save collect your paycheck. Money, yeah. So, and honestly, at this point, I knew I was going back. I knew what we were doing. The war was ramping up.
And you were on your third tour.
Right. It was my third tour. So I didn't ever plan on coming home again. Mm. Like, this was my last run, and so spending the money wasn't an issue. And I had set up to where I had interviews with some of the contracting companies for when I got out of the Marine Corps to go right back over there and just make better money.
Yeah.
So that was my plan, was I'm just going to die in the Middle East making as much money as I can. So we not put off by me for whatever reason, because I keep calling her, and the reason I was calling her is because I hate being told no. So at this point, it's now a challenge. Like, I'm like, I can't believe she didn't go home with me.
Imagine that.
Yeah, I know. How stupid we are at 27 years old.
Right.
So a few days later, it's been like 2 or 3 days, we go to Six Flags together. And
Six Flags.
Yeah. And she's a little strung out and not feeling good, and she was a partier too. And so I just said, hey, why don't you, and my buddy, and I needed his help to make sure that I could seal the deal. It is what it is. Yeah. But so
you needed somebody to be on the couch.
I needed someone to be on the couch. I finally talk her into coming to this party, but we're going to get drunk, and there's not going to be a way for her to get back to where she's staying. And if the couch is open, I know that's where she's going to stay. But if he's on the couch, there's only one other place to stay in the whole house, and it's in my bed. So,
oops.
Yeah, he drove.
So
from
the homie, like last minute, drives all the way from Houston.
He drove from Houston to come up there to Denton, so I could get laid. That's the kind of friends I had. I know.
You still have them.
Still, I got them now, but yeah.
I would drive.
I would help you out like that.
So, we went out, and he got a little too happy that evening and couldn't make it through the next day, and she was hungover and he was hungover, and so I let her take the truck. I had rented back to Denton, and I was like, look, we'll figure it out. So
from Six Flags,
I didn't care. And that night she met us somewhere in between Six Flags and Denton at Bennigan's. And
Bennigan's.
I know, right? So I show up at Bennigan's. We've been running around Six Flags all day. I'm sure I smell awful, and I'm sweaty and nasty. And I get there, and she had been crashed out at my buddy's, at Nate's place. And she put together an outfit for me and kind of got everything I needed to get cleaned up. And I get to Bennigan's, and she's like, here, I brought this for you. And I'm like, oh, my God.
Aww.
This is the one, right? Like, she actually thought about me, and I'd never had that. And my buddy's wife actually pointed out, like, the next day, so when are you going to tell her? And I was like, tell her what? She goes, that you love her. I'm like, have you lost your fucking mind? But she was right. 2 days later, I met her parents out here. I drove from Denton to Chandler, Texas.
Wow.
And met her dad and her mom. It was a Friday morning. And, or Saturday morning, excuse me. And then we drove back to Dallas that afternoon, and she met my dad and stepmom. And, on Sunday afternoon, I invited her to my traditional going away luncheon, because I had already done this a couple of times.
Yeah.
And she shows up without a bra on and combat boots. Like, she's a Denton chick, and that's how she met my mom.
Wife beater?
No, not that bad. although I wouldn't have had a problem with it.
I'm getting like Edward Norton's girlfriend in American History.
She's kind of a little wild though.
Black lipstick.
Yeah, absolutely. She listens
gauged
to the
ears,
Cure.
Nose
gauged
ring.
Ears, without a doubt.
Labrum.
No other. But she did have gauged ears. And,
okay. I can't see it now.
I know.
Yeah, I can't either.
Yeah, and they were large, like that.
They were big.
Yeah, like she had like a zero or something. It
was
massive.
Wild.
I love it.
But I brought her to lunch. My parents were pissed because she shows up in combat boots, and my dad's like, "If I ever meet her again, tell her not to wear those god awful boots."
Mm-hmm.
All right. So we go to lunch, and then the next morning I get on an airplane and go back to Iraq. Now, we've all met parents and whatnot, and I've told them, like, this is going to be my wife, and I'm going to take care of her. And I sent her home. She was planning on moving to San Francisco when I met her. She was homeless, essentially. She had just graduated college and was staying at a friend's house until everything finalized out and she could leave. This was in August of 2004, August of 2004. And when I went to her parents' house, I'm like, look, I'm sending her home to live with you. She hadn't talked to her dad in like 6 months. Mm. Now, they didn't have a good relationship at the time. So I sent her back to Chandler. She stayed with them on their couch for a while, and then they set her up in this little barn apartment that they had a friend that had. And I had a satellite phone in Iraq because of the job that I did, and I called her every night for like an hour.
That gets expensive.
Well, it's the government, so I wasted a buttload of taxpayer money.
Taxpayer's money, yeah.
I don't have no idea about tens of thousands of dollars of a phone bill that I would have rung up there, but we talked about everything. You know, for a while it was all the fun stuff, like you're dating and whatnot, but, you know, after several months, you've got to get to the real thing. So we talked about religion, and this was the first time that I'd ever expressed my beliefs in any way. And while I wasn't active in any church and hadn't been to a church in a long time, I wanted somebody who believed, right? Like, I wasn't interested in going through that. We talked about children and all the different things, and when I flew back to the States, her dad, my father-in-law, drove from Tyler to San Diego in her car, drove her across the country and dropped her off with me, and then caught a flight back. And we got married about 6 weeks later.
Wow.
So we were together in person for 6 weeks before we got married, but had been together for almost a year, 11 months when it actually worked out. So that was the start of it. December of that year of 2005, I got out of the Marine Corps on terminal leave, and we moved back to Texas, moved to Denton, and lived at my buddy's house for a couple months while we figured out where we were going to be. I started with New York life.
Really?
Yeah. Lived in Louisville, and that's where the career started off. And had a couple of really good home run type pieces, you know, like made some good money and went into management there, and that shipped us off to Louisiana, where I took over as a trainer in the New Orleans office, which was the hardest time of our entire marriage.
Really?
Oh, yeah. It was a terrible place for me to live. The drinking and the drugs and the debauchery that happens in New Orleans put a strain on our relationship. We had a young child. My son was, you know, my daughter was one, I think, when we moved. And then a couple of years later, Connor was born in New Orleans. And we struggled tremendously. And there was an opportunity to take over the Tyler office for New York Life and move back. And she had told me that she's never coming back to East Texas.
That's what we always say. I know. That's what we always
Of course, I had never been to East Texas except to meet her parents.
Right, yeah.
But we moved back here. We needed to get closer to family. We needed to have some more, you know, stability in our lives.
You got kids coming, and it's like, to be in, I mean, New Orleans is what, 7 hours,
yes.
8 hours?
8 hours.
And it was just a difficult time. There were so many problems there. I lived an hour from the office, and often it was my job to entertain people coming into town, because when
so late nights,
I'm getting home at 2-3 in the morning, drunk. So we struggled a lot, and then moved back to Tyler, and I took over the office here, and that wasn't an easy move. I had to go back to being an agent and hit certain milestones before I could go back into management again. So I gave up a salary and stability and moved to a new place where I didn't know anybody at all, and had to hit these milestones. And that took several months, but once I hit them, I became a partner at New York Life, and we did okay. We struggled a little bit. We have kids in that, you know, 6 to 10 range. You know, I felt like I was last on the totem pole, and I wasn't giving her the support she needed, and I wasn't getting what I needed out of the marriage, and we came close to getting divorced, to where I was packing a suitcase close. And I was very fortunate. I had a mentor in my life named Randy Marshall, who, if he's still around and alive, he was one of the greatest men I've ever met. And he just gave me a lot of really solid advice for marriage. You know, we were talking earlier about staying together for the kids. That wasn't it. We were having lunch one day, and he had two questions for me that kind of helped me change some aspects of my life. The first one is, he said, the problem with where we're at today is we don't know the difference between goals and desires. You've heard this. And being in corporate America for the 14 years that I was there, I didn't understand that, because we always had goals, but they were always driven from a corporate standpoint. And he said, all these are actually desires, but you don't have control over them. Mm-hmm. So he asked me, he said...
Yeah, I've heard this guy like five times.
He's so fantastic.
The New York Life brought him in all the time.
Absolutely. That's how I met him. And I was so thankful that he decided to take me under his wing and help me through some of these times in my life. But he said, Jared, is it a good goal to raise responsible, financially independent, successful children? I'm like, absolutely. He says, is it a good goal to have a healthy, successful marriage? I said, yeah. He goes, well, that's your problem. You're wrong on both of them. I said, those are horrible goals. So let me ask you a question. I said, if you're the best husband you can be, you do everything you can for your wife, you make her breakfast in bed, you go to work, she gets to stay home, whatever you want to do, and she wants a divorce, what are you getting? I said, well, I'm getting a divorce. He goes, that's right. He said, when you set a goal that you can't achieve because of somebody else, those knockdowns, they hurt really bad, and it's hard to come back from them. He goes, but it's because you've set a goal that's not realistic. He said, your goal should be every day to be the best father you can be. And if you're the best father you can be, and you're leading by example, your chances of having those responsible, successful children goes up. Mm-hmm. And if your goal is to be the best husband that you can be, and her goal is to be the best wife she can be, then the chances of you having a happy, successful marriage goes up a lot. And I had never understood that I was basing a lot of my goals on her output or my children's output or the company's output and not on mine, because I had the wrong idea. So Andrea and I went from, I'm walking out the door, I've got a suitcase, we're both in tears, to we're going to try this and see if we can't make it work. And we had a weekend getaway at the mansion in Dallas to kind of rekindle and reset our priorities and reset our goals. And my marriage has been spectacular ever since. I'm not saying we haven't had fights on occasion or that we see eye to eye all the time, but the goal is ultimately, am I being the best husband that I can be to her? Am I doing the things that she needs me to do to take care of her? And she spends her days making sure she's being the best wife. And because of that, I really don't know anybody else that has a better marriage than I do.
That's good.
Yeah.
So, and she's extremely supportive, and she's a very traditional wife. Today she made sourdough from scratch, and I had like a sourdough breakfast sandwich.
Hashtag trad wife. Hashtag passport
bros. No passport. I found her in Denton, Texas, but I understand the desire for
that. Hashtag Texas women.
That's it. I love Texas. Now they're strong. You got to be careful.
Yeah.
But she is a strong woman, but she's not an independent woman. That's a dirty word in our house. Mm. And I will tell anybody who says that they're an independent, tell you that I'm an independent man, y'all would laugh at me because that's silly. But there's a lot of women that describe themselves as strong, independent women. And my understanding is one, I'm not independent of anything. Hmm. God leads my life.
Yeah.
Every time I've strayed off of that path to do it on my own, I have seen how horribly I do at that. Like, I can screw 100%. Up an anvil. And I'm interdependent on my wife. I need her for my life to be good. And I think wives need to understand, and women in general need to understand, that if you say that you're independent, what you're saying is, I don't need my spouse. They're here for fun. They're here for enjoyment. And as soon as you stop entertaining me, I don't need you. I'm out.
Well, needs get demonized when men are talking about it, but when women are talking about it, men get feminized.
Yeah.
There's a lot of security that comes into play when all of a sudden you have somebody to depend on. And I understood that as a man because I was so isolated for so many years from other men. But the transition that I've had in my life at this church and in these last few years has been really eye-opening for everybody around me, but especially my wife, to understand that we're in this, not just the two of us, but God is the head of our household. Mm-hmm. God is our leader, and I follow God, and she follows me, and the children follow her. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't mean that she's secondary to me. She's the most important person in my life. There's nobody higher than her. But it helps us to make sure that we're keeping that Trinity together. And when we face these struggles, we know that there's support there, even when we don't feel it all the time. And it's been a really wonderful place for us to be. And I would recommend that, you know, men and women together take the time to go, hey, I want to be, like, we signed up for this. This is not, like, you don't get married to be happy.
Yeah.
Happiness is great, but the truth is life sucks, right? Like, it's a bunch of shit. Things go bad. I've lost businesses. I've lost friends. I've lost careers. I've done things that I'm ashamed of. I have, you know, problems from my time in the Marine Corps that still are there, whether it's pain or mental anguish that comes along from doing the things that I did. And my support system of following God and having my wife, who is always there to support me and advise me, and, like, she is the first person I turn to, because I know that together we can be successful, and she knows together we can be successful, but the odds of us being successful on our own are very slim.
Very.
So it's helped me tremendously to have those revelations and to be able to come to that place through this church. But in a nutshell, that's how it all happened. So we'll celebrate our 20th anniversary this July. I have a daughter that turns 18 in July, and then Connor, of course, is 14, so he'll be starting his freshman year next year at Brownsboro.
One morning, like a year ago, a year and a half ago, I was standing in the parking lot in front of my car, and I think you had just gotten her this car she's got, you know, and she pulled in, and she backed up and pulled forward, and she backed up, and she rolled the window down, and she said, "Excuse me, sir, can you please, I would like to park in that parking spot." I'm like, I'm not standing in it, you know. I'm like, go for it. And she goes, "Could you just please move?"
Brand new driver, man. You're brave to stay there.
Yeah. And I was like, that was the most direct communication I've received from a high school student.
Yeah,
you know, it was funny, but it was also like kind of impressive in a weird way. You know, like, yeah. I was like, oh, that's pretty cool.
You know,
but she to me. From where I sit, because I'm not super close to your kids, you know. Yeah. I mean, I was a little scared on that duck hunt that, you know,
Connor
was going to shoot me. Yeah. Because, like, when he was loading it, he kept, like, turning it. And I was just like, how did they move me to this spot, you know?
Yeah, well, we should
put him on the left, you know. Your kids have, I can see the fruit in your children. Mm. I can see it. I can see that they're happy, that they feel safe.
Yeah.
I can see that they trust you, and that they have other adults and other people in this church that they've connected with. And they're not going to, hopefully, you know, and I hope this for my kids too, that they don't have to live a life of isolation the way we did.
Mm. I hope so.
You know, because the dangerous spot for that, to me, is like 16 to 25.
Absolutely.
You know, that's when all the scary, dark stuff, really can come, because you're undefended against it. Life gives you the, you know, test, and then you get the lesson. And if you're like me, you have to get the lesson like 100 times.
Oh, yeah.
And then it's like it's an open book test, and I'm still failing it, you know? And so if I think those relationships, that discipleship, that bringing you in, you're a part of this deal. Like, that gives them some substrate to grow in. You know what I mean? It gives them a spot where they can safely make mistakes, you know?
And it takes a village, though. They have to see the support that I have to understand that's available, right?
Like, right.
For the first several years of their lives, I never invited anybody to my house, ever. I can tell you.
It's like a vacuum.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't think the entire time that I lived in Tyler, I ever had a guest at my home.
Wow.
That wasn't family. It was a sanctuary, and I didn't leave it. You know, I spent all my time working on the house or in the back. It's safe. Because that's something I deal with. You know, I'm driving down the road. If there's a bag of trash on the road, I have a panic attack. because I'm afraid it's going to blow up and kill one of the vehicles in front of me or behind me, or heaven forbid, mine. Because after you see a couple of vehicles blow up from that, it's hard to let that go. And that's some difficulties that I've dealt with for a long time. And the support that you can get from having other people, and for men especially, to having those men in your life that can go, hey, I've got your back. You know, if you need something, if you're having one of those days where everything seems to be going wrong, and like nothing has to be going wrong, but you know, I spent a lot of years very suicidal, and with the primary question of why am I still here. You know, not everybody came back. I lost a lot of good friends. I've lost more friends to suicide than I lost in Iraq.
Wow.
And it's just because they can't deal with the pressure and the strains of the things they've seen or things that they've done, or just, you know, going, man, the guy next to me died and here I am.
Yeah.
So, you know, there was a lot of time that I just figured my time was short. And now I have so many things that are important to me that, you know, thank God for my wife, but I eat much better than I ever have eaten. And, you know, health is something that's important to me, maybe because I'm pushing up on 50 now, but that I want to be here for a long time. You know, I want to see my kids grow up. I want to be a part of their lives. I'm hoping that someday I have grandchildren a long time from now. But finding your way to that place where you can have a relationship with your Lord will bring peace that I've never known before. And still to this day, of course, I live out in the middle of nowhere. Trey's been out to my place. If I don't want to see anybody, I can go weeks without seeing a person.
Yeah, it's very easy.
Yeah.
And I've seen the bass.
You've been out there.
Yeah, I've seen the bass out of that pond.
Yeah.
What else do you need?
That's it. You know, a little catfish and bass, you'd be good. Yeah. But it's one of those pieces where, you know, I would have gone months without seeing a human if I could have at several points in my life. And now, like I said, Sunday morning is my favorite time of the entire week, because that's where I get to actually see the people that matter outside of my immediate family that matter the most. So it's been a real wonderful experience to be a part of all this. And now for me, it's what can I give back? How can I help the next person that's suffering, the next person who's gone through, you know, drug addiction, or has gone through, you know, abuse or divorces. You know, I had a divorce. It wasn't an ugly divorce. Three months. It's kind of hard to accumulate a lot of stuff to separate out. But I would recommend that you find a church that's very accepting, because for my children, it saved them, and I didn't realize how much danger they were in as we made our way into this building.
Yeah, I mean, whenever you start to see the way the kids are dealing with things, handling things, you start to see that not only are we defenseless against the things of the world, but also the world is on the offense.
Absolutely.
Like, they are trying to perpetuate these things from the time that they're kids. I mean, the more that they grow up, I heard a statistic the other day that just by watching TV, your kids will witness like 20,000 murders.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, hell, I think my son witnesses that every day on the Xbox.
Yeah, exactly. So. And you know, when we are left to our own vices and we're not able to steer that, that's how we end up with all the stuff that we have going on at schools. We have them in colleges and you know, all the different varieties of methods that, you know, sin has really crept in and is trying to attack our children. That's something that I think that it was very pivotal in your life that you needed that wake up, not only for yourself, but also for your children. And that's something I'm very thankful for. Like, I love Connor. Like, he's a cool dude. Like, we went to camp last year, and I was so upset to see him break his leg.
That's going to be one of the best stories he'll have for his entire life, is breaking his leg at camp.
Yeah, I'll have to have him tell it.
There was, you know, very little information came out when that happened, you know? And so, like, amongst other
churchgoers, we were like, maybe they're just being bitches, you know? And like, and then it was like the next time I saw him, you texted me and you were like, no, this is what happened. I'm like, okay. And then he was in that boot, that cast leg cast forever. Thing.
Yeah.
And I was like, I kind of felt bad because initially I was like, man, he didn't really get hurt.
I know.
Yeah. Like, but I was like, but Jared would know. Like,
yeah.
And you know, I mean, like, that must have been wild.
Yeah, I was so proud.
I think he handled it pretty good.
He didn't cry or anything. So he didn't cry until we got back. We got all the way back away from the kids. And he doesn't cry very often. And we were off to the side. So he broke his leg in a mud wrestling thing, right? Like, there's a giant mud pit. And somebody got thrown into his leg and his knee went the wrong way. And, you know, we threw him on a golf cart and took him up. I had to find a water hose. Like, all the showers were messed up. Dude. There was no water. Yeah. So I'm hosing him off out there, and we finally get him cleaned up, and his leg's all swelling up. And, of course, you're in the middle of nowhere. It's not like there's a whole lot of places to go. Yeah. And
Gertie, Oklahoma.
Yeah.
He starts crying. I'm like, dude, it's going to be... He goes, man. He's like, Dad, we don't have the money for this. You know, I was unemployed. And didn't have health insurance and didn't, like, I had fallen through the cracks in the system. And here I am with a son that has a broken leg, and his biggest concern is not the pain he's in, but how are we going to pay for this?
Yeah.
And that was a real heart-wrenching moment for me, but one of those pieces that I understood that my son was growing very well. Right? Like, he was... And, you know, I said, hey, we're going to figure this out. Don't worry. It's not, I mean, they're going to take care of you. It's not like they're going to tell you, suck it up. You can't pay for this.
Go cut it off by this piece of wood.
That's it. But it brought our family a lot closer together. It brought me and my son a lot closer together.
Yeah.
Like I said, you know, we went duck hunting 4 times this past year together. Mm-hmm. And that was his first time to ever go hunting or really to shoot anything. And he and I have just had quite a relationship growth over the last couple of years, and it's been centered around this building as well. So there's not enough I can say of God. Like, I believed in God, but I'm like, but I'm not his. Like, he doesn't want me,
right?
Because I have a very self-destructive nature. You know, you don't do the things that I've done without being able to do that. So I do everything I can to be the exact opposite of what I was, as far away from the type of person that I was, to become just better. And I'm sure that there are a lot of people that go, yeah, Jared, you know, he's probably worthless, I guess. You know, he's not the guy you're going to call in a fight necessarily. He's always happy-go-lucky. I'm not going to start anything with anybody. But, man, I've been so violent in my life that... You know, if I never have another violent day, that would be a good thing for me. Now, I haven't forgotten. So, if it comes up, I'm not concerned about it. But ideally, I would get to spend the rest of my life in the peace that I live in now.
You're trying to be a warrior in a garden.
Absolutely.
And you've got a garden now.
I've got a garden. I've got, you know, chickens and gardens and all that wonderfulness and more eggs than we could ever eat.
Yeah.
And Andrea has this thing about chickens. She's already telling me we need more. I'm going, we pulled 30 eggs out yesterday. Like, I don't know what we're going to do.
Let me tell you something. How many chickens do y'all have?
I don't know. Probably 20. Somewhere.
20?
Yeah.
It can turn to 40 very quick.
Yeah, she's all about it. And I don't mind building anything. So, like, I'll go out and I'm a tool guy. So, you know, she's like, I need this. I'm like, absolutely. We'll build that. But then she fills it up with something. So, you know. We have,
we'll see what happens when the EMP goes off.
I'm not worried, I'm prepared. Right?
Like, just send her to a lock-in and bring Tucker over, and you won't have any more chickens.
No, Tucker goes over there. He damn near got shot earlier this year because he got out and ran to our neighbor's house because they have chickens, and he was trying to get into their pen, and we heard a gunshot go off, and I'm like, where the hell is Tucker at? And Travis is like, oh, shit. He's dead. So it took us like 15 minutes to find him.
Dude, I really don't understand what it is. Like, I've had chickens before, but if somebody's dog came up and ate one of my chickens, honestly, I really wouldn't be that mad. I'd be like upset that you didn't control your dog in the situation. But like, if a dog eats a chicken, then it's not like it's written off for the rest of its life. Because like, I love my dog.
Like, yeah, absolutely.
Like, I will hurt somebody for my dog. You think that you're going to hurt my dog
because it's very John Wick type
it
thing,
eats
you know?
A chicken.
Yeah, I'll buy you another chicken.
A 60-cent chicken. I can get you 10 chickens. Just let my dog live.
Absolutely. So, you know, we've had a great life, but you really get married to have somebody to go through the roller coaster with. So you've got that person there with you that can go through the trials and take the slings and arrows with you, because I don't have any problems facing the world every day, but I can't come home and not have my wife and my children and the peace that they bring me. Now, I understand there's a lot of people out there that don't have peace in their marriage, and that's something that they can find if that's what they're looking for. But it has to be their goal, is to be the best they can be in that relationship. And I think in today's society, we've been taught to be what you want to be and to go after whatever makes you happy.
Do what thou wilt.
And the truth is I'm the happiest when I'm doing things for my wife, and my wife is the happiest when she's doing things for me. Like, I can see the joy it brings her.
When you eat that sourdough sandwich.
Oh, man, I was out of control. I loved it this morning. I always come home, like, I'm surprised I don't weigh 300 pounds. But, you know, it's something when I look at her, I'm like, this is incredible. I said, thank you so much for taking care of me. And it brings her joy to know that her family is well taken care of and well fed. And they have all the support and the love and the nurturing that they need. And for her to know that I'm not going to let anything come into that world and upset that for her.
Yeah.
I've got to protect her from all of those pieces. And it's worked well for us. I don't know that it would work for everybody, but for my family, it has been probably the greatest gift that we've ever been given, is being able to follow God and understand that there's a much higher calling to this marriage than just being married.
Yeah.
And I'd never understood that before.
Hmm.
You know, I grew up in a divorced house. I watched the fighting. I watched the problems. My friends all went through, you know, they went through divorces, or their parents went through divorces. And, you know, I kind of thought that's just what happened, and it doesn't have to. I didn't realize that.
What a gift it's been to have you share some of this with us, a lot of your story, you know.
This is the best episode ever.
Yeah, everyone. It seems like, you know, the next one's probably the best,
too. I hope so.
You might be surprised.
I don't know. Shout out. I don't know how to tag her in this, but yeah. I'm not leaving my wife, but I mean, I'll think about it.
Damn. Well, is there anything else you want to leave us with, or you got it all out there?
You know, there's so much to be thankful for. I'm really glad that y'all invited me on. I just wanted to be a part of this and understand that even though I'm not one to share anything, this is the first time I've talked about it, but watching men share their stories, their history, Trey, hearing yours, knowing about your past and the incredible stories that you've had, you know, people really do need to hear that there is salvation on the other side, and there's an opportunity for them to be successful, and there's an opportunity for them to live the life that they want to live when you're not focused on what the world tells you to be focused on. You know, as soon as I stopped focusing on the financial part of it, I wasn't chasing the nice cars and the nice house anymore, and I was more focused on making sure that my family felt the love that they needed and they had the dad that they needed there. It really makes life a better place to be. You know, it takes away the stress that the world demands we be under. Mm. So I'm real thankful for y'all just inviting me to be here and putting up with some of my difficulties.
Oh, man.
Loved it. Loved every minute.
Awesome. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, this has been another episode of Two Dudes, One God Pod. Look out for the next one. It'll be on a Friday, like they always are. Y'all have a good one.